But right now, happy to welcome back to our program a longtime Green Party activist and radio show host himself, Mike DeRosa. Mike, thanks for making time to come on our program tonight.
It's really a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So it was great. We talked a couple of weeks back after the election, and we wanted to update listeners on some of the races that Green Party folks, including yourself, ran here in Connecticut on November 8th, as well as looking forward to the new year and some of the issues that the Green Party and their allies will be working on statewide. But first of all, maybe I can ask you just a bit about your own race, because as I understand it, you ran for Congress. You ran in the first district, there are other candidates as well that I know will want to summarize. But tell us about your own race first, Mike.
Yeah, we did pretty well. I got 2.1% of the vote for Congress in the first congressional district. Mr. Pelto got 1.7%. He ran in the second congressional district. We both raised fundamental issues that were not being discussed by the two candidates, the Democrats and the Republicans. I've got into a debate with John Larson and raised questions about his policy towards student loans, which is very poor. He would like student loan people to work off their debt, as it were, through public service. And I reminded him that in 1971 he graduated from Central Connecticut State University and paid $100 a semester. Right now at UConn, it's $13,336 or so for tuition. And I didn't quite understand why he could get a free education and I could get a free education at UConn, because I graduated in 66 and I paid $100 a semester, $200 a year for tuition. But that's not available to the student population that is attempting to build our country. And I also talked about the issue of military conversion. Mr. Larson is a big supporter, along with the establishment Democrats here, of the military-industrial congressional media complex, with an emphasis on congressional. And, you know, he has his fighter jet, F-35 fighter jet, a speech, and this is very troubling. But we did have a nice conversation, and he's a very amenable person. You know, he has voted against wars, but he votes for the military budget consistently. So I think we have a lot of anomalies in Connecticut, you know, issues that have to be resolved. The Democratic Party has to decide whether it's going to be a party of the people or a party of Wall Street. And, of course, you know, when Donald Trump said you're fired, remember what the acronym there is. You know, it's F-I-R-E-D-D, which is finance, insurance, real estate, dumbed down. And I think people have got to start to realize that we have to follow the money.
Well said. Mike, what about the statewide ballot for Jill Stein? As I think I understand correctly, she exceeded the threshold necessary to have the Green Party appear on the presidential ballot next time out, 4 years from now, in the 2020 election. Is that your understanding?
That's absolutely correct. She got about close to 1.5% of the vote. We needed 1% to get on the ballot. We also ran 26 people on the underticket, all of them qualified, including U.S. Senate candidate Jeff Russell, got just over 1%. So every office that we ran for, we got ballot access, which is a big deal because, as some of your listeners may know, we collected almost 17,000. It's actually 16,800 signatures. We needed 7,500 to get Jill on the ballot, along with our senatorial candidate. And luckily, Jill had a little money this year, so we collected about 8,400 signatures from paid people, and then our volunteer base, which included a lot of Bernie people, roughly 400, carried petitions for us, and we got another 8,400. So that added up to 16.8, which was twice as many, more than twice as many signatures as we needed. But I've had people call me and say, you know, this election proves that elections are useless, that we should abandon this whole approach toward progressive politics. And I respectfully disagree, because if these forces that we're up against, these so-called establishment forces that we're up against, have put such barriers between us and the ballot, that kind of indicates that there's something there that they're afraid of. And I think what they're afraid of is that people become exposed to information and ideas that are much too dangerous to be discussed in debates between Republicans and Democrats. And I would say that our analysis is that we have a one-party system in this country. They call it the War Party, I think. There's a few people on the left and a few people on the right who understand the dilemma that we're up against here. It's pretty clear the establishment press, which is pushing forward this fake news agenda, see, I thought, you know, someone at the New York Times might have remembered back in the Iraq War, weapons of mass destruction. That was fake news. I guess it's okay if our enemies, you know, we have stories about our enemies which are fake news, as long as it's politically correct to whoever, you know, the enemy du jour may be.
You know, I wanted to just bring up the idea of third independent parties here, and maybe two parts. The first part is there was a nice bit of news from the state of Maine this election, where they passed a referendum where it's the system known as instant runoff voting, or I think they call it something else up there, but it was the first state in the country where federal offices and statewide offices will have people rank their choices, you know, from 1, 2, 3, and 4 on a ballot, so that if the winning candidate doesn't get 50% or over, then there's a mechanism to weigh people's second choices, so that, for instance, you know, in a gubernatorial or a Senate or a congressional race, you didn't like the Democrats so much, but like the Green Party or vice versa, your vote would not be discarded, especially where there are multiple candidates running for a particular office. Anyway, Michael, you know, certainly clarify that in any way that might make more sense to our listeners. But it seems to me it's an important development, you know, to really prevent the whole notion that voting for a third party, voting for an independent party that's not the Democrats or Republicans, is throwing away your ballot.
Yeah, I think it'll help people to have choice voting versus strategic voting, if you want to use that term. Strategic voting is you want to vote for what you don't want by voting for what you don't want. I mean, voting for what you don't want, and so hoping that you will get what you want. And I think that the idea would be that people could choose the philosophy or the candidates that they feel are closest to their self-interest or to their desires. And I think the irony of the situation with Trump is that he was able to convince lower middle class people that their interests were going to be taken care of by him. And he used some, you know, pretty crude but creative linguistics. You know, what do you have to lose by voting for me? And he was able to carry on this sort of populist theme, but there was no substance to it. And this was very clear to me that Democrats are doing something very similar. You know, so if you don't have a choice, you're willing to take a chance, especially if you have nothing to lose, from your perspective. I think that what we need is real democracy in this country, not only, the idea of instant runoff voting, but, you know, proportional representation. Like, for example, in Germany with the Bundestag, half the candidates are elected by district, half by percentage. this allows many different viewpoints to have power within the legislative branch. And I think this is the critical element at this point. The reason I ran for Congress is that the Congress is just not representing us. When it comes to war, you know, we invade Yemen or some other country, Somalia, and there's no discussion at all. I mean, it's like political, wallpaper. I mean, the president is, a king or an emperor. He can just declare war whenever he wants to, and the mass media sells it onto the population on the basis of fear and loathing and frustration, over the issue of terrorism. And, you know, I mean, I think one of the critical issues that we need to discuss both statewide and nationally is the surveillance state, which is going to be controlled by Trump and his flunkies. And how are they going to use it? And Obama has not been good on these issues. I mean, Ed Snowden is correct when he says, I can't get a fair trial if I come back to the United States, and I'm happy to come back and face charges because I want to state why I did what I did and what happens, you know, under the act that he's being charged on. He can't even give a reason, a legitimate reason. You know, the Espionage Act of 1917 doesn't allow you to present in court an argument about why you did this. For example, you know, that the government was violating its own laws, so I therefore needed to stand up and speak about this. There's other issues. You know, I think the core of the problem is that our system has become so corrupt. And again, follow the money. I mean, look at where these candidates are getting their money. They both are vassals of the, you know, Wall Street elite and the 1%. And they don't represent people anymore. They represent corporations and extremely rich people.
Hey, I wanted to ask you about the presidential election results on a sort of national scale. How much criticism has the Green Party come in for regarding Jill Stein and the vote she got in some of these key Rust Belt states like Wisconsin and Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and the like, that may have made a difference in terms of winning those states for Hillary Clinton? You know, kind of a replay of the criticism leveled at Ralph Nader. We all have been through that debate many times, where he was blamed for taking votes away from Al Gore in Florida in the 2000 election, where, of course, if that state had been recounted, Gore would have won and won the presidency. He did win more votes than George W. Bush that year, and George Bush only won the presidency because of a, really, in my view, an illegitimate Supreme Court decision. But anyway, just in terms of third party as spoilers and that whole thing, we've talked about a lot. What kind of feedback you've been getting since November 8th?
Well, I think, you know, you can blame the libertarians, you can blame the Greens, you can blame the FBI, the head of the FBI, you can blame the Russians, you can blame, sunspots. The Democratic Party at this point, under the tutelage of the Democratic Leadership Council, didn't get it before, hasn't gotten it during the election, and didn't get it after the election. I don't think we've come into as much criticism, but I think the recount effort was opposed by the Democrats. You know, I mean, they had people who showed up to, you know, in those three critical states, but they didn't support it. They didn't use their political capital to push it. I mean, here's an article from the Detroit Free Press. Detroit to get new voting machines as city clerk blames state and human error. That's because of Jill's recount effort. And this is what it says in the article, that they're going to get new machines. And then there's, of course, the infamous Greg Palast. You know, he had an article here. November 30th, 2016, the no BS inside guide to the presidential recount. Sorry, no Russian hacker hunt. Nope, they're not hunting for Russian hackers, the ballot in the election dumpster. And it makes a good point that there's spoiled ballots. We saw this during the so-called primary, which was, hijacked by one part of the Democratic Party. You know, the Democratic Leadership Council is doing well, and they're still controlling the Democratic Party. So, you know, I think it's really sort of academic about, well, who's the lesser of the two evils here? You know, I think the two-party system is evil, and it has to be dealt with, you know, through not only third-party activity, but demonstrations in the street. And look at what's going on within the struggle for the head of the Democratic Party at this point. Yeah. I mean, it certainly is educational to see the efforts to which people are going to keep the Bernie Sanders people out. So right. We welcome all the Bernie Sanders people into the Green Party. Many of them have joined. We don't claim to be the answer, you know, ultimate or penultimate or whatever answer to the problems facing the country. But, you know, if I hadn't been in those debates, or Mr. Pelto hadn't been in those debates, the issues that we raised would never have been discussed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is the primary problem. We have to start thinking that we don't live in a two-party state. We live in a one-party state. And, you know, it's kind of a, you know, a bird with two right wings, you know, and I've never seen a bird with two right wings ever fly. So this is the problem, and the military-industrial, you know, congressional media complex is alive and well, and it's running Washington. And I'm afraid that we're going to try to restart the Cold War. I mean, certainly that was the agenda of Hillary Clinton. There's no question about it. And look at what the New York Times and some of these other newspapers. I mean, it is a anti-Russian diatribe of the first order. Say whatever you want about, you know, Trump, but the fact is, at least on the surface, he's trying to direct this energy in a different way. Now, we know that he's not serious about it, that he's a liar, and that his true efforts are going to be shown through his appointments. You have people that, you know, the head of the EPA doesn't believe in the EPA. But it's going to be very difficult to eliminate these agencies.
Yeah.
And I don't think that they're going to be able to destroy every single agency. And the question is, will the Democratic Party and will the progressive forces in the Democratic Party oppose this kind of right-wing takeover of our country?
Yeah, and that certainly is a question that goes to everyone in the country who cares about breathing clean air, sort of pushing back and trying to mitigate the worst effects of climate change, which the incoming Trump administration looks like it's hell-bent on destroying the planet maybe a few years sooner than it otherwise would have been. Frightening stuff, Mike, and I just wanted to ask you about electoral reform a la, you know, the referendum in Maine. We don't have referendums in the state of Connecticut, but do you see it worth your while for the Greens to get on board some electoral reforms so that, you know, the dynamic now that we don't have a system where it makes it a vote for a third party, an independent party like the Greens, you know, a more viable vehicle to register your protest with the system as it is. How important is that for the Greens this year?
Well, I think one of the biggest issues is the Connecticut Public Bank. We're going to be pushing this. Ed Heflin, down your way, is on board with this. He's an expert. He's got a PhD in physics, but he has several master's degrees, and he's been writing the bills, and we're trying to get it into Mr. Leone's committee there, banking committee. But they, you know, they believe that we have lots of good banks here in Connecticut, and this is socialism. You know, quite frankly, for the sake of argument, you know, in 2027 or 2028, you know, there's a financial worldwide collapse. You've got to have banks. And the next time there's going to be a banking crisis in the United States, it's not going to be any more bailouts. It's going to be bail-ins. So when you go to the bank, this is what happened in Cyprus. It's happened in Greece over the EU strangulation of those countries. So we need banks, and we need public institutions that will protect our financial future and protect our social security from these people who want to eliminate that program and Medicare to boot. I think this is the primary moment of truth.
Well, just to interject here, though, mention, if you would, the model for public banking is North Dakota, which has had it since, well, how many years has it been? It's been...
It started in 1919.
1919. So we're talking about a long test period of public banking. It has not found a home in other states, but the effort is on, as you say here, by some Green Party folks here in Connecticut to talk about public banking and the benefits in North Dakota. It's worked really well. Before we run out of time, Mike, maybe just mention a few of the benefits that you see if the state of Connecticut were to adopt a public banking system.
Well, first of all, we could use our entire budget of $20 billion and leverage it for loans and for development, real development in the state of Connecticut. Actually, it's closer to $25 billion if you include some other assets. And that's not even including, you know, our retirement program. You know, I mean, if you go out to the website at North Dakota's public bank, you'll see they give out student loans at 3%. They're investing in the infrastructure. Now, we know that there's a real problem going on in North Dakota right now. But, you know, there's enough wind power in North Dakota and South Dakota to produce almost all the necessary electricity in the United States. I wanted to mention this really great thing that's happened outside of Black Island. You know, deep water wind has put up 5 generators of electricity, windmills at 6 megawatts. It's a major development, and it's 30 miles off the shore, so you don't have to look at them. You know, you don't have any aesthetic problem with it because you can't see it. And they're having plans to do the whole East Coast. There's other people on the West Coast. This is the future of energy in the United States. That's what we should be investing in, and that's what is really about the public bank, because we can get these things through a public bank if we can keep it honest and if we can put the right people in and get this kind of legislation passed. And our position has been that you can save $1 billion a year in the first year with a public bank, in the second year 1.5 and 1.8 the third year. And we think we can prove it, and all we've asked for from this legislature is to do a study about whether this could work in Connecticut. I guess it's too radical for the Banking Committee with Mr. Leone and his cohorts there who opposed this idea on ideological rather than rational reasons.
We're going to have to continue this discussion. We got another program coming up, and the tyranny of the clock is upon us. Mike, leave our listeners with the website for the Green Party website here in the state of Connecticut. How can they get more information?
Just go into Google, put Green Party of Connecticut, and it comes right up. There's all kinds of information, when our meetings are, what we stand for, and we do stand for You're Hired, humanity installing real environmental democracy instead of You're Fired.
Okay, well done. Thanks, okay. Mike. Good talking with you. Happy New Year, and we'll see you soon, I hope. Take care.
Keep up the good work. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Bye-bye. That's Mike DeRosa, Green Party activist, candidate in the 1st Congressional District this past election, November 8th.